If these hormone differences can impact your sexual orientation, are you sort of familiar with the research on how these changes might also impact gender development?
Yes. I mean, there's much less biological research being done on that has been done on trans people than on gay people. So one has to be more cautious, but most of the work that has been done suggests that very similar mechanisms influence a person's gender identity as influence their sexual orientation.
I mention it because, of course, Ottawa here has the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario, and the endocrinology lab does hormone blocking in young trans folks. Just as a great way of really essentially putting the pause in puberty, so they can figure that out. And there's been some longitudinal studies in, I think it's Denmark, for trans youth who transitioned prior to puberty, and they're just much, much happier in, on almost any scale compared to those who transitioned.
You touch on a very contentious topic there, because the problem is, you know, everyone wants these kids to be happy, right? The problem is that plenty of very feminine boys who say they want to become girls or want to become grow up as women, actually, you know, if you don't treat them when they get to puberty and adolescence, they change their minds and say they're very happy to be men. They're often gay men, but they don't want to change sex. So the risk is you're going to do something drastic to a child which actually wasn't necessary, and it's going to lead to a result that's, you know, going to be imperfect and maybe not even desired.
But then on the other hand, if they do identify as the opposite gender when they're younger and then they grow up and they're happy with it still, the younger you start the hormone treatment, the more more of an effect you get on the adult body.
Yes.
It's very complicated.
That's true. Of course, if you allow puberty to go forward in a boy who says he's a girl or wants to be a woman, then you're going to have all kinds of changes that are going to be very difficult to reverse later on. And that's the point of these puberty-blocking drugs that allow the child to stay in a pre-pubertal state for a few more years until they're a little bit more intellectually mature and can make a decision. So it's not a bad idea to do that, but although there are problems associated with it, no question about that.
Yeah, so it's, again, it's this combination between the, you know, social acceptance and what's socially responsible versus the science, because in order to show, you know, the dangers or the benefits of doing these puberty-blocking hormones, we have to actually give people puberty-blocking hormones, and we have to study it and come up with these longitudinal studies.
It's an ongoing experiment, and which some, you know, some children are, you know, perhaps unwilling participants in, and it'll take a few years to figure out whether that strategy is really the best one or not.
I think it's definitely seen some success here in Ottawa, but of course it's still, like you mentioned, contentious even here with...
Well, it's awkward because the only way to find the cure to cancer is to give something that's not the cure to cancer to a couple thousand people first.
I wouldn't necessarily make that comparison,
but
sure.
It's, I mean, to see what the best course of action is, we have to just do what we think might be the best course of action and then hope we're not wrong.
With regard to this issue of blocking transgender children, the main thing, I think, is not to sort of try and correct the gender, if you like, of that child, not to sort of try and force them to become more conventionally masculine or feminine, and to love them and support them, but not necessarily to say, yes, we're going to go ahead and you know, make this transition as soon as possible, because that may actually be counterproductive for many kids.
And there's the class of there's a lot of trans-identified people who are fairly okay with their biological body, but they want to live as the opposite gender. And so, you know, they remain a woman and they bind their chest and they live as a man. But at the end of the day, they have no particular interest in taking hormone treatment because it's more about the cultural aspect. And so it takes a while to figure that out.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a decade or two ago, the thought was, you know, you either had to be your birth sex, or you had to switch over and have surgery and hormone treatment. Mm-hmm. And now it's much more flexible. You know, you can be more fluid in your gender identity than you used to be. And I think that's a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. And you can pick and choose which of the procedures actually interest you as well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. For example, a lot of people have, you know, top surgery but not bottom surgery. And that seems to be a happy state for a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
And not all trans women are getting tracheal shaves anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They usually turn out well, but when they go poorly, they go very poorly. Luke is giving me a look. Yeah. A tracheal shave, what they do is they actually remove the cartilage so that you no longer have an Adam's apple.
Oh.
And appearance-wise, you have a more feminized neck, but if it's not done just right, it can actually mess with your vocal folds.
Mm. I think the Adam's apple was actually in your book in one of the studies that was referenced.
I don't remember about that.
There were 650 of them.
The really central issue is, particularly for women who want to transition to men, is that phalloplasties are very inadequate and not hugely successful surgery. So that's why many trans men basically forego that surgery, because it's not hugely successful.
Mm-hmm. And anytime that we deal with this, and I think that this is something, it's an interesting point that you brought up, where in the past you had to be either strictly male or strictly female, or there was, if you're going to medically transition, you have to go do all of the surgeries and all of the hormones. And I think now we're starting to realize that by supporting people's identities, we also kind of have to support what, if any, medical transition they want to do, and let them make decisions about procedures that they might not want, which could be very practical in the case of phalloplasty, but it could also be just very personal in terms of what parts of your body do you want surgery on.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely.
We're seeing a great degree of nuance around trans health. Are we seeing the same kind of nuance coming out? And as you mentioned, there's some great new research with gay-identified and lesbian-identified women, but are we seeing much more interesting nuances coming in terms of sexuality studies?
I think so. There's a lot more interest in, for example, in bisexuality, in fluidity of sexual orientation, particularly in women, you know, the idea that people can change their identity to some extent. So all these are, you know, refinements of our approach to the subject that need to be made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the field of how sexual orientation develops is diverse, and there's a lot of new things coming out, especially as we get access to new technologies, and people are more willing to come forward and identify themselves as a sexual minority. What do you find most exciting right now as you witness all of this research coming out? What really excites you?
Well, you know, I'm a biologist, and I guess I would say that the genetic studies are the most exciting, because that really does get at something biological that could be at the core of somebody's sexual development. There's now evidence for several locations on the genome that really do influence men's sexual orientation. And finding out what those genes are and what they do is really, you know, something that is probably will be done in the next few years. So that to me, that's the most exciting. Now, whether the similar work will be done in women or on genes, I don't know, but there will be certainly more work on hormonal mechanisms in women, and that mm-hmm. would be very exciting.
Mm-hmm. I think actually, it just occurred to me that I think I actually might be most excited about the genetic aspect as well, and there's a reason. In genetics, there is almost zero understanding on how encoded genetic information turns into abstract things like behaviors and desires. The link between them is so incredibly foggy. There's a name for the break in the connection. I can't remember what it's called. It's called the difficult question or something. I can't remember.
I completely agree with you. And you know, the simple-minded thought about it is, you know, if you look carefully at the DNA letters, you'll find sort of G-A-Y or something there, you know, or S-T-R-A-I-G-T.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's absolutely as remote from that, you know, the truth, as you can imagine. There's many stages between genes being expressed and people, you know, feeling sexual attraction to one sex or the other.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much entirely, you know, unknown territory at this point. So that, but I think identifying the genes and finding how they work is the door to beginning to unravel that all those steps from
that
one to the other.
Weird link, yeah, because with other things, it's just like, you know, you have DNA, protein, enzyme, and then now you know how sugar breaks down into energy. Like, we know these things very clearly, but we have no idea how behaviors come out of genetics. This actually makes a really interesting case study.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some ideas, but
it's guesswork.
Yeah, it is. Well,
it's guesswork.
I wouldn't say complete guesswork. We know some of the ways that genes could possibly, you know, influence behavior, but yeah, there's a lot to be learned. And I remember being in probably in high school and reading these biology textbooks, and it made it seem like we knew everything, and it made it seem like there was no controversy, and like scientists had done the biology thing. Here's a biology textbook, go. And now that I'm in university and now that I'm a researcher, I realize just how much there is still to learn, and that really excites me.
I have a human sexuality textbook that's an undergraduate textbook, and I know that there's tremendous pressure for textbook writers to say how it is and, you know, black and white kind of way, because students want to know, you know, what is the facts that they need to know, forget about all the doubts and the sort of complications. And it's difficult for authors sometimes to really convey, you know, how complicated things really are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that we'll catch at least some of those new epigenetic studies in your new edition that's coming out. I know that we'll certainly be keen to give that a review and hopefully promote it to our listeners here in Canada. I'm actually excited to see what new developments there have been. So it's going to be a great read.
Yeah, well, thanks. The book's supposed to be in the hands of the publishers at the end of this year, so I'm going to hassle the guy who led that study to, you know, give me an advanced copy of his paper if he has written one, so I can make sure it is in the book. But
it's also generally understood that published or completed by the end of December really means handed in March.
No, I'm actually kind of pretty compulsive by getting stuff done on time. But you do have plenty of opportunities later for putting in stuff and revising, you know, as the editing process goes on. So I'm hopeful that I'll get that topic into the book.
Excellent. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us and what has been a fascinating and really wide-ranging conversation around the possible causes of sexuality.
Well, I'm very happy to talk to you. It's nice to sometimes have an intelligent conversation. which doesn't always happen on the radio. So.
Oh, my God, that just made my day. Oh, Simon LeVay just said I was intelligent.
Well, thank you so much, so much. Next week, we are actually talking about LGBT homelessness. Of course, it's a problem that's disproportionate to the LGBT community. I want to thank you again for joining us on the call. We'll be playing out with The Hidden Cameras, which is a Canadian LGBT Canadian band, with their song Doom. And nice and cheerful. I don't know why I chose that one, but we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Thanks again for having me on your program.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We don't feel too rich with fire.